In the new book, The Founding Fortunes, historian Tom Shachman reveals the ways in which a dozen notable revolutionaries deeply affected the finances and birth of the new country while making and losing their fortunes. Tom Shachman on this week's Book Show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In the new book, The Founding Fortunes, historian Tom Shachman reveals the way in which a dozen notable revolutionaries deeply affected the finances and birth of the new country while making and losing their fortunes. While history teaches that successful revolutions depend on participation by the common man, the establishment of a stable and independent United States first required wealthy colonials uniting to disrupt the very system that had enriched them, and then funding a very long war. While some fortunes were made during the war at the expense of the poor, many of the wealthy embraced the goal of obtaining for their poorer countrymen an unprecedented equality of opportunity along with independence. Tom Shachman has written or co-authored more than 35 books as well as documentaries for all the major TV networks. He has taught at New York University and lectured at Harvard, Stanford, Georgia Tech, the Smithsonian, and the Library of Congress. The new book is The Founding Fortunes, How the Wealthy Paid for and Profited from America's Revolution. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Tom Shachman to this week's book show. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me on.
So what brought you to this particular chapter in American history?
Well, as you know, Joe, since we've talked before, I've been on this kick about the revolution for about 10 years. And I think my fascination with the funding for the revolution goes way back. Many years ago, I did a film for National Geographic about who paid for the revolution, or the ordinary people. It was called Not Worth the Continental. And that had to do with ordinary farmers who would get approached both by the British sometimes and by the rebels for food. But this is a book about really the larger subject, not only who paid for the revolution, who profited from it, and how the financial setup of our country is absolutely integrated into our winning the war and our being stable after it.
You very much get the idea of the impact of how the war was paid for and really how it influenced really the culture of America, didn't it?
Yes, indeed. Remember that before the war, the only way of really getting rich in America was by a direct connection with the British Empire, that people who weren't international traders had only a limited scope of things that they could do. They didn't have any banks. There weren't any corporation. There was no real way to amass money. So what the revolution did was it essentially freed American commerce to do whatever it wanted to. And this is something that we really don't generally think about in terms of the revolution. We talk about political freedom and political independence, but we don't really talk about economic independence. And by the way, I don't think economic independence was achieved in 1781 or 1783, but it was getting on the road. It took really another generation for that to come about, but at least it began to be possible. One of the things that we see, one of the interesting statistics, is that for the Continental Congresses before and during the war, almost everybody in them was a wealthy heir to a fortune, or they'd made their money through their family business.
Right.
After the war, And by the time we get to the Constitutional Convention, 40% of the men there are self-made millionaires. They were able to do it by themselves. That had never happened before, never in America.
Why do you believe that this idea of the role of affluence in the revolution hasn't played a greater part in the history of the revolution?
Well, we sort of accepted that the people who were involved at the top level were wealthy people, but we didn't look at them as wealthy people versus poor people. Sometimes people say, well, yes, it's the poor people who fight the wars, and of course it is that. But the generals were not poor, generally speaking, and it's not an unimportant thing. Today we talk about the 1% and whether we're being ruled by the 1%. The fact is we were always ruled by the 1%. But the 1% back then had a real understanding that they were there also for the poor in their districts, and that they had to take care that things were good or getting better for the poor in order for the country to survive.
I was going to bring this up later, but since you have brought me there, let me ask this question now, which is, when I picked up this book initially, I thought, oh, so this is a book that shows that when we talk about that 1% now, our history is steeped in this 1%, and this is going to be really, we're going to see how bad all of this has been throughout our 230-year history. What you get in the book instead, however, is realizing how it worked pretty well then, and has in some ways developed and in other ways devolved.
Yeah, I think as I said, it really has to do with what these wealthy people felt was their obligation to the people who did not have the kinds of money and properties and things that they had. After all, property was not equally distributed. That's why Jefferson kept it out of the Declaration of Independence. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are shared by everybody. Property is not. So property was something that these wealthy people understood. They understood they had it. They understood that other people in the country were just as good people, but they didn't happen to have money, and it needed to be not necessarily taken care of, such as giving alms to the poor, but they had to be given opportunities. And it's the opportunity to make your own life, to make your own fortune, that's at the heart of what America is, not simply in its democratic terms, but also in its capitalist terms.
When you speak of those capitalist terms, we think now that much of that 1%, many will say, is motivated by greed, where that would not have been the case from these founding fortunes.
I think this is true, Joe. I mean, accumulation for its own sake was not something that happened with an awful lot of people back then. You went into business, you conducted your business, you perhaps made money. You certainly looked for every opportunity to make money, but it's not the full sense of your life. Your life existed outside of the making of money. There was many other things that were going on, and especially in this kind of subset of the wealthy who became involved in the running of the army and the running of the government. Remember, this is only maybe 50 to 100 people, not a lot of people in the country. We had 3 million people at the start of the revolution and growing at a fairly substantial rate. So we're talking about a very small subset of people who wished to get involved. And most of them had a tremendous conscience and understanding of what everybody else didn't have. And while they were just doing fine by themselves, they understood that they had to bring everybody along. It wasn't clear to them exactly how this would play out, but the facts show us that it actually did. You know, the middle class began to surge, more property went into the hands, and especially in urban property, of people who'd never owned property before. Small farms were being opened up. America was continually growing towards the West, and they were growing in the sense of people being independent. This was not a country of big cities where everybody had to work for a wealthy person. It was becoming more and more possible to work for yourself, have your own farm, open up your own workshop. And these are the ways, the small, almost invisible ways, that wealth is created.
So let's talk about some of the names, and certainly the ones that stand out from history that we know, beginning with John Hancock.
Yes, John Hancock, whose signature we know.
Certainly.
We don't really know him too much. He was a dandy. He liked gold-tipped cane. He liked very rich wine. He liked to ride around in a gilded carriage. And he was called a traitor to his class by many of the wealthy merchants in Boston. When he threw in his lot with Samuel Adams and his cousin John Adams and other leaders of the rebellion, it wasn't even a rebellion at that time, it was just a resistance. When you think that a guy like this, who made all of his money from Great Britain, was willing to shut his warehouse, stop importing because of the Stamp Act, and then later because of the Townshend Act, this is an act of conscience. And it's an act of throwing your lot in with everybody else's. The tendency for all of the other wealthy people in his class were, don't make waves. We have a good life. But that wasn't enough for people like Hancock and for people like Henry Larned down in South Carolina, whose name we don't know too much, but who followed Hancock into the leadership of the Continental Congress. And he was a similar sort of businessman. He actually had four plantations. He had been a slave importer, and he stopped that. He got terribly turned off by that in the early 1760s and stopped doing that. But he was a very good Tory. He sent his children to school in London, and he would have stayed a member of the British Empire, but they kept pushing him away and pushing him away. And finally, he became the president of the Continental Congress, a great friend of Washington's, and pushed hard for the kinds of things that we know that make America what it is today.
You write early in the book, two important committees of Congress had been formed to exploit the old boy networks of the wealthy for the benefit of the United Colonies, and they were led by experienced participants in such activities, Benjamin Franklin and Robert Morris. Let us talk about Robert Morris.
Morris is obviously less well known than Franklin. Actually, Franklin at that time was the best known American in the world. But Robert Morris was a merchant in Philadelphia. He had a partner, a slightly older partner, Thomas Willing, and they were real up-and-comers. They had done a tremendous amount of business. They had depots all over the world, places like Bilbao and the French Caribbean, and they did a lot of international business. And so the idea that we had to provide arms and ammunition and guns and cannon and everything for the forces in America fell to him as part of Congress to be able to try and get that to happen, because it was not a simple task. We didn't manufacture any of those things in America, so they had to be obtained from abroad, and you had to get them through the British barricades on the sea and on land. So they needed somebody who knew what he was doing, who had credit abroad, who was not adverse to advancing his own credit so that these kind of deals would go through. And Morris took on that job. Many people didn't like him. Many people didn't like that he was mixing private business and public business. But he was probably one of the few people in America who could have actually gotten the job done at that time.
And where does Franklin fit into that? Because Benjamin Franklin did not have that level of money, right?
Actually, you're wrong. Franklin had more money at that time than Morris did. He was one of the wealthiest Americans. We don't really know this about Franklin because he played on the wonderful Poor Richard thing. But he was a wealthy man, but he had come from a relatively poor family to begin with. He'd made his money the old-fashioned way, what we now think of the old-fashioned way, which actually was a new way then. He'd just gone out and earned it. But he was a very savvy businessman by this point, one of the older members of Congress, in his late 60s when the Continental Congress began. And he also had spent many years in London and some in Paris, and so he knew some of the players that would have to be utilized in order for America to get the arms and ammunition, and even things like blankets for the soldiers. We didn't have those. They all had to be imported somehow, and we had to find people willing to sell them to us. And what were we going to pay for? How were we going to pay for it? The only way was with crops. We paid for it in tobacco, paid for it in rice, things like that.
Tom Shachman is our guest. The name of the new book is The Founding Fortunes. Just in that brief section that I read, you talk about the old boy networks, which they were looking to address, which I guess amuses me because you think of the creation of our country, that there really wouldn't be time to have old boy networks.
Well, these existed before then, but let's look on the other side of it. Where was the bureaucracy? There wasn't any.
Right.
Or if it existed, it was all British. So we had no people who spent their lives learning how to be purchasing agents for the government, how to do this, how to make those kinds of deals. We had to turn to the people who knew how to do that already, people like Robert Barr, people like Jeremiah Wadsworth of Hartford, and a number of other merchants who were already in this business and decided to put their knowledge, their expertise, and their credit at the service of the country in order to get something done.
You also write about Elias Haskett Derby, another example of someone that we may know, but also played a pivotal role.
Well, Derby was the son of a sea captain, and he'd been to sea himself, and he owned maybe a half dozen vessels at the beginning of the war, and some of them were seized by the British, and not for particularly good reasons either. And this enraged him, and he decided that the only way he could remain in business was to turn the remaining vessels into privateers. And privateers, by the way, are not pirates. Privateers are licensed pirates, and they're licensed by the government. So it means you go out raiding on the high seas, and the government is your partner. You bring a prize into a court, it's sold, and a third to a half of the money goes directly to the government. And this was a new way of doing things for people in America. And Salem, where Derby was from, became the center of privateering. Derby prospered through this. A couple of things are interesting about it. One of them is that he was constantly profit-sharing with his crews, not just the officers, but the men, the deckhand, and even the people who unloaded the ships on the docks. And as a result of these practices, his ships were making more voyages per year than those of his competitors, because he ran not only a good ship, but a very profitable ship. So people wanted to work with him and were willing to speed things up so that they could go out, let's say, five or six times a year instead of three or four times a year.
You have a quote in here from Robert Morris, who writes, "This appointment as superintendent of the Treasury was unsought, unsolicited, and dangerous to accept, as it was evidently contrary to my private interests." You're writing in there also about, which I found fascinating because we think of it, certainly we know about it as an issue today, especially with our deficit, but at the very beginning, government spending.
Yes. Well, there was certainly no choice at that point. We didn't have a treasury. Matter of fact, much of what might have been expected to be in people's private accounts, pounds and other foreign currency, were gone because the British had instituted a system before the war where if you wanted to pay for something, you had to pay for it in coin or in direct money printed in England. And so all of that sort of went over to London. So there was very little there. What we had were individuals' credit. And the country, in the form of the Continental Congress, decided to print money. This was not a new or novel idea. Individual colonies had done it before. What was new was that there was really nothing in back of it. You've seen these kind of certificates. They say, redeemable for gold or silver. Well, that's what these said, too, but they weren't, because there was no gold or silver there to be redeemed. The only real thing that there could have been would be tax assets, future tax receipts. And if you're running a revolution on the basis of a slogan, no taxation without representation, it's very difficult to tax people. So there was almost nothing in back of these continental dollars that put us into deficit. By the time the war was over and the Constitutional Convention began, the deficit was up at $77 million, which was 30% of the GNP. Now, today we worry about it when it's a 2 or 3% of the GNP.
Morris worked very hard to get Congress to charter the Bank of North America. Enter Alexander Hamilton. What role does Hamilton play in helping that become a reality?
Well, he didn't have much to do with the Bank of North America. Matter of fact, he had one, it was a somewhat competing bank that he was trying to start in New York, later called the Bank of New York. But when the Bank of North America ran into trouble in Pennsylvania, there were a number of rules that were put on that were going to let it be not quite so rampantly capitalist. There was going to be a limit on how long the bank could stay around, a limit on what kind of holdings they had, a limit on who could own it, or those sorts of things. And so when Hamilton began the Bank of the United States in 1791, the same sort of restrictions were put on that because those restrictions had proved to be a good idea for the public. And that bank worked very well. My only difficulty with it was that it was so reserved for the rich that it cut out 90-95% of the people in the country who couldn't have anything to do with it, and that there were other ways of setting up banks. There was one in Boston that was set up around the same time. They floated 100,000 shares at $8 a piece. Now, anybody could buy those. It was pretty darn difficult to buy a share at $400 a piece in the Bank of the United States when $400 was maybe 3 or 4 years' income for an ordinary person.
You write that in a long letter to Morris, Hamilton described what a superintendent ought to do, how taxes ought to be levied progressively so as not to hurt the poor, and the need to create a national debt which, quote, if it is not excessive, will be to us a national blessing, a powerful cement to our union, which you note is something that that had been Webster had said earlier about that, about debt. So that's where we see the rules start to
somewhat, yeah,
be created.
The idea of powerful cement is what Hamilton really liked. The United States at that point was a collection of 13 states, none of which had really acted in accordance with one another.
Right.
And by the time we get to the Constitutional Convention, you have tariff barriers, for say, from New York City going to New Jersey and going to Connecticut. Goods would come into New York, and they'd have to pay a tariff before being allowed to be shipped to Connecticut or to New Jersey. And so there was a whole history of the states not pulling together. And what Hamilton wanted to do was he said, look, we have this national debt that has to be paid down, or at least has to be paid up, because you have to, it's accumulating at 6% a year. So what we really need to do is get everybody to pay that together, have a shared obligation, and that shared obligation will hold us together. And part of that happened that way, so that by the time that he left office, when, by the way, the debt was actually higher than it had been before, there was more coherence, there was more sense of a country pulling together rather than a collection of states.
Tom Shachman is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the book is The Founding Fortunes, How the Wealthy Paid for and Profited from America's Revolution. It is published by St. Martin's Press. Let us talk in our remaining moments about the wisdom of that time and the validity it has now.
Well, Joe, I'm actually often asked, do the founders have anything to say to us anymore?
Yeah.
Has the world not changed so much that their wisdom is out of date? And the answer I found, and certainly in doing this book, was that the founders grappled with many, many of the same kinds of problems that we have today. They looked into whether they ought to have a wealth tax, how punishing should their tariffs be, what was the obligation of the wealthy to the poor, all these kinds of things. So they actually looked into some of this stuff. For example, one of the things that they were committed to, even though they didn't call it by this name, was progressive taxation. And today we've just seen articles recently that say that we're no longer as progressively taxing as we were, and that the top level people are paying actually less as a percentage of their total income than people much further down the scale. So can we not listen to that kind of wisdom saying, of course the wealthy need to pay more? That's part of the United States. That's part of, not simply a part of our history, but it's part of not only of our tradition, but of our moral understanding of what we are as a country.
We saw its creation. We know what we have now. Did it ever really work the way it should have worked?
Well, we don't really know what we expected. I think you have to say that things work when time proves them to be continually effective. There were questions about what Hamilton was doing with the debt. But 5-10 years later, when there are 20,000 individual holders of America's debt, that's a pretty great bet on the future by 20,000 people around the country and actually in around the world. So we have to say, did it work? Well, what about the millions and millions of immigrants who came here, not necessarily to be free, politically free, but to have the opportunity to make their own lives by themselves, make their own fortunes, or if not fortunes, at least more than enough to get by and to pass on to their children the opportunity to make it in America.
There, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but there seems in the creation of our country among these founding fathers that there was a trust, and maybe I'll ask it as a question, was there a trust that doesn't seem to exist today, where many will look and say, oh, the government is out to screw us? Did people have that same feeling, or was there a trust in the founding fathers?
Well, first of all, the government wasn't big enough to screw anybody, so let's leave it at that. But and there was no sense of entrenched bureaucracy or entrenched anything, or and the taxes, such as they were, really at a very minor level. Except, you know, for example, if you wanted to import a gilded carriage, yes, then we'd tax you.
Right.
So it wasn't even a question of trust or distrust in government. You always have, in any civilized country that aspires to some sort of democratic thing, people who are more conservative and people who are more liberal. But that's just a question of temperament, and as well as anything else. It's not a question of coming by it through wealth or non-wealth. Certainly, if you have wealth, this idea always is, let's not rock the boat, let's not make it go away. It's a wonderful thing to have. We want to keep it that way, which tends toward generally conservative things. But the liberal things are not actually opposed to that. The liberal things are saying, no, keep what you have. What we need is to make more opportunity for others to be able to get to that level if they can. And that's what's available in America, has been available in America, continues to be available in America. It's why people want to come here.
The name of the new book is The Founding Fortunes, How the Wealthy Paid for and Profited from America's Revolution. Tom Shachman is the author. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. What a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for
sharing. Thanks, Joe.
Great pleasure having you. Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows, and you can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.